How many of you, if I were to ask the question, would say, Devin, I would love to live the good life that these guys, One Republic, were just singing about? How many would say, I would love to live the good life, whatever that means, whatever that looks like? We all want to live the good life. We want to see good days. We want to love life as we're living it. We don't want life to be this kind of begrudging task that we have to go through. We would love to see good days and love life and live the good life. And I imagine if we were to take a survey on what that would look like, we'd probably get a lot of different responses. If we were going to ask One Republic, what does it look like to live the good life? Well, according to their song, it means I'm going to wake up in a lot of different places, in London or in L.A. I'm going to travel the world and kind of lose consciousness of where I'm at. That's kind of the gist of their song and their interpretation of living the good life, kind of this free spirit idea. If I were to ask a lot of kind of average people, including us, if we were to define what does the good life mean, we'd probably define it by either what we're doing or what we have. For some of you, it may mean that living the good life is I finally am able to move to the beach and wake up every day and put my toes in the sand. I think there's a song about that too, Zach Brown or somebody. How many of you, that's kind of your definition of the good life? I would like to end up somewhere, beach, toes in the sand kind of good life. Maybe a lake house. For some of you, it may have to do with what's in the bank account. The good life that you interpret the good life is that you have money in the bank account, that you can buy what you want, you can get the big screen TV. But a lot of times, the good life would be defined by what we have or what we're doing, which often entails money. Some of you are the opposite of that. In your mind, the good life is you just want to wake up every day and sip coffee on the porch and sit in a rocking chair by your spouse. I heard about this older couple. They had kind of reached retirement age, and they were living the good life. They were sipping their coffee late one evening, and there was a little country church down the road from them that was having their monthly singing. If you grew up in church world, you kind of know what that's about. And so they were having their singing, and one of the people in the older couple was listening to the choir sing from the old country church, and the other older person was listening to the chirping of the crickets. In their mind, that's what they wanted to hear. And so one listening to the choir and one listening to the crickets, and they were both just sitting there living the good life, sipping their coffee, and they looked at one looked at the other one and said, "Man, that is such a beautiful sound." To which the other one replied, "Yes, it is. And the rumor has it that they make that sound by rubbing their legs together." So the one listening to the choir didn't really know how to take that. When you have to explain your jokes, you know they're getting really bad. Living the good life. Peter discusses the good life in our text today. And he grounds it in who we are. And who we are in Jesus and how that impacts how we live life. And Peter, if you remember, is writing this letter to a group of people that we have called the suffering saints, people that have been exiled from their homes, that have been kicked out of society and ostracized, and they're going through a really difficult time. And Peter is answering this question, how do we live as dual citizens, citizens of an eternal kingdom and a temporary kingdom at the same time? How do we live as exiles passing through this earth? And what we've seen for the last few weeks is he uses this crazy term that's not always a positive term in our life context today, but a very biblical term. Peter says that we are to live a life of submission. And how we do that is what we're going to look at in today's text. And Peter has said we're going to live a life of submission under this kind of umbrella of people that God has placed over us, from the government, from the people that we work with, and then even last week, we talked about how do we live this type of life in the home. And I want to encourage you, if you were not here last week, to go back and to listen to the message or watch the message on video. Ashley was able to join me on the stage and talk through a lot of things. And I actually did a little follow-up video this week. I hope you got a moment to watch that on some of the things that we talked about last week as we try to put the biblical truth into everyday context. And that's what Peter's doing. And what he has to say today has to do with everything we've been talking about. Why are we to live this life of submission, this life of operating kind of under this umbrella that God has placed around me, and specifically in relationships? the relationship approach. How do I interact with other people? If it's that boss, that spouse, the people in my neighborhood, my family, the relationship impact that this approach has, how it flows out of who we are. It flows out of our identity. And as we've said every week, who I am impacts every relationship. Who I am in Jesus impacts everything about my life. It even impacts how I interact with people that treat me unfairly and unkindly. So for the last few weeks, we've talked about some very specific relationships, haven't we? Like with the election upon us, and man, it's been a fun week in politics, right? Name calling and making fun of people's ear size and all kinds of fun stuff in politics this week. But how do we interact in that society, in that culture? How do we interact with people at work or that boss that seems to treat me unfairly or at home? We've talked about some very specific relationships. And then today, Peter goes very general on this. He talks about just some general life principles. And right in the middle of our text today, we read these words from 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10. It's actually a quote from the Old Testament. Peter says, "For whoever desires to love life and see good days." Peter says, what I'm talking about has to do with loving life and seeing good days. Man, that's something you want written on your tombstone, right? Like, Devin loved life. Devin saw good days while he was here on earth. And again, the solution to that question, how does that happen? We often wrap it around all the wrong things. What we have, where we're at, how much money's in the bank. But Peter takes us in an entirely different direction. And what he's telling us is the key to learn how to love life and to see good days. Let's jump into our text. We're actually going to back up to verse 8 is where we're at in the book of 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. "Finally, all of you..." And then look at this laundry list that Peter gives us. "Have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind." So Peter says, finally, so at the end of this thought process, after he's talked about our relationship with government and at home and in the workplace and with society as a whole, he says, kind of at the end of this thought process where I've been dealing with specific relationships, let me talk to you about a general life attitude. Because our attitude is often revealed by how we live life. How many times when I was a teenager did I hear my parents say, "You need to change your attitude. You have a bad attitude." How did they know I had a bad attitude? Usually it's because of how I was behaving, right? The look on my face, the words I was responding with. They knew my attitude by my actions. And so Peter says, let's talk about attitude, because your behavior is controlled by your attitude. And then he gives us these five things in these verses. The first one he talks about is that we are to live a life of harmony. He calls it unity of mind. In other words, we're not to live a life that is divisive. Now, Peter is not saying that as Jesus followers, we're all going to be uniform. He's not talking about uniformity, and he's not talking about conformity. That's what we call a cult, where everybody looks the same, says the same, dresses the same. And when you see that, you're kind of like, man, that's weird. So that's not what Peter's talking about. He's not talking about uniformity. As a matter of fact, the New Testament celebrates the diversity within the body of Christ, that we've all been uniquely gifted and created by God to live out God's purposes in our lives. And so that looks very different, that we're all diverse, but there is a unity within the diversity. And that's where he talks about harmony, that we are united. I like to think of it as like an orchestra playing. Everyone's kind of playing their own instrument, but when all the instruments come together, they create hopefully a beautiful melody, a beautiful performance. Have you ever been listening to a band or an orchestra play where one instrument was slightly off? When I was in high school, I was involved in this competition that involved all types of different things, from music to sports, all kinds of stuff. And I had a friend that was in the music side of it, so I was in there listening to the performance. And there was singing and there was instruments being played, but this one guy got up to play the saxophone, and I will never forget this as long as I have a working mind, it's clear. But when he got up, I was sitting, of course, with all my buddies, and this guy got up to play the sax, and he was going to play Amazing Grace. And it went something like this. And when he hit that note, like, my buddies and I all lost it. Like, got kicked out of the room, lost it. Like, you guys cannot be in here because of how you're behaving right now. But I'll never forget that moment of that one sour note and the look on that poor guy's face when that note came out of the instrument he was playing. We've been in those contexts where something was a little off. But Peter says, when we are living as Jesus followers within this framework of who we are in Jesus, that we're going to live a life of harmony and unity with each other, that we are agreeable, that we are like-minded because we have the same Holy Spirit, we worship the same Jesus, we have the mind of Christ, Paul says, and we're on the same mission to continue what Jesus started, that we live in harmony. We know that sometimes the church struggles with that. You heard the little poem, "To dwell above with saints we love, that will be grace and glory. But to live below with saints we know, that's an entirely different story." Right? That's kind of how we live life as a church. Not always in agreeable harmony, but Peter says when your life is defined by who you are in Jesus, you live a life of harmony. And then he says we live a life of sympathy. The original word here actually means to suffer with someone, to suffer alongside, that we are sensitive to what is around us, that we are sensitive to who is around us. The Hebrew writer of the New Testament said that Jesus sympathized with us in our weakness. Have you seen these things that are called sympathy suits? So like if you do not have sympathy for a certain person that's in a certain life context, you can wear a sympathy suit. So like a pregnant lady, they have sympathy suits where you can wear a suit to feel and understand at some level what it seems to be pregnant. My daughters have been in high school where they had to create little babies so they can understand the burden of what it means to live life with a baby. So this is the one last year that I helped Reagan create. There's flour in here, a bag of flour. And then I don't even know how we made this head, this wobbly head. It's got something to do with duct tape and pantyhose and something. And then we super glued this pacifier on and put the little clothes on it. And if Reagan's acting up at night, I just sneak in a room and put this right beside her bed. So she rolls over and wakes up to this. It'll change your life perspective. I want to like have a little voice. I read this thing on the internet yesterday that I read to Ashley that said, there's nothing cuter and sweeter than hearing a baby laugh unless it's 2 a.m. and unless you don't have a baby. And so you want kind of, you know, to have the baby laugh. But this is supposed to help young ladies understand the burden of having a child in high school. And hey, you don't want to have to carry around a bag of flour when you're 15 years old. So it's a idea of sympathy to help you identify with someone. Carry around a fake baby, and it'll maybe help prevent you from wanting to have a real baby at an age that you're too young. It puts you in someone else's place, someone else's story. And that's the idea of sympathy, that I suffer alongside, that I have empathy and sympathy and feelings for and understand what people, seek to understand what people are going through. And then the third phrase he uses is brotherly love. This has the idea of loving like a family. And when you love your family, you defend them and you take up for them and you take care of their needs. And sometimes even when they do not deserve to be defended, you find yourself looking out for your family, don't you? And taking care and justifying sometimes. And, you know, you can talk about anybody in the world, but don't talk about my family, right? Peter says that we display brotherly love, that we love and take care of each other like family. And then he uses a word that is the idea of kindness, that we live a life that is kind. This is a deep-seated emotion. The actual original Greek word here is a feeling that comes from your guts, like an inner deep-seated emotion of being compassionate and tender. And then the fifth word he uses is the word humble, that we are to be humble in how we live life. This is a willingness to put other people's needs in front of mine. That's one of the reasons that we serve a lot at City Church is because we want to put other people's needs ahead of ours, because that's the example that Jesus gave us. I heard about the one guy that won a pin, an award. He won a pin for being humble. And he won a pin for it, and he decided to wear it, and so they had to take it away from him for wearing it. Right? Like, that's one of those characteristics. It's like, how do you say you're a humble person? It's not really an expression vocally as much as it is a life attitude. I love the story of Truett Cathy, who is the founder of Chick-fil-A. Whoop, whoop. And Truett Cathy, who started Chick-fil-A, who recently passed away in the last few years, if you know anything about his story, he started with just a very simple kind of restaurant model that he, you know, sold sandwiches for 65 cents and Cokes for a quarter back in the day. And he had like 10 tables and stools in his little restaurant. And he grew it into this multi-billion dollar company, Chick-fil-A. But if you have heard the story of Truett Cathy, you know that he was a very strong believer, follower of Jesus. As a matter of fact, for 45 years, even while Chick-fil-A was growing and becoming a multi-billion dollar company, Truett Cathy would teach the young teens, boys, Sunday school class at his local church, all the way until the time that literally right before he passed away, and that he built his company. A lot of his company was built on the model of being a humble person, of understanding. And so that's kind of humility on display, that no matter how wealthy and famous he became, that he understood where he was coming from, and he placed other people's needs in place of his own. And so these five traits that we read about in this text of living in harmony and sympathy and kindness and brotherly love and being a humble person, these five traits are Jesus traits. They're things that he lived out, that he lived a life of kindness and sympathy and brotherly love and humility. Paul said they humbled himself and took on the form of a servant. That these are Jesus traits. And as we continue what Jesus started, that we're living out what Jesus lived while he was on earth. And we'll talk about in a few moments what does it look like when we can't seem to live those things out. But Peter then takes us in the direction of everyday life. He gets specific on us again, like he often does. So look what he says in verse 9. If we're going to live these traits out, what does that mean for everyday life? Well, he says, we do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For to this you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. And so Peter says, as we live out these Jesus traits, it impacts us. And in this case, it impacts how we react, that we're not a people of retaliation. Now, I'm a reactionary person. I, like a lot of us, by nature, react to things. And a lot of times my reaction starts here and then ends here after I've kind of had a moment to process. But Peter says that as Jesus followers living out Jesus' traits, it impacts how we react, that we should not be people of retaliation. Well, I'll tell you what I would have done. Well, that'll be the last time that happens. Or I'll tell you what's going to happen next time. Right? Where our natural reaction is to react. And it's that way from the time we're children on the playground and living out, well, it takes one to know one. Well, your mama, right? We're kind of born that way, and we're natural reactors. And we kind of sympathize with people who are reactionary. I'm a reader, and one of the guys I like to read is I've read all of John Grisham's novels, and probably his most successful novel that he's ever written that was turned into a famous movie is A Time to Kill. And you know the story of A Time to Kill. You know it's about this young African-American young girl that was raped and murdered by these guys. And her father, who Samuel L. Jackson plays in the movie, reacts by killing these guys as they're being brought into the courtroom. Then Matthew McConaughey's the lawyer that defends him in the movie, and the book even gets into more kind of graphic detail about the story. And you, like me, probably the first time I actually read the book before it came out on movie, but the first time I read the book in those final chapters, when kind of the cliffhanger of the story and the jury exonerates Samuel L. Jackson and basically declares him innocent, I was the guy who was reading the book like, yes, I'm glad he got off, right? Because he was retaliating and reacting. And it's kind of our natural instinct. But Peter says when we are people that have Jesus traits, that We are not people that are known by retaliation. Instead of reacting and retaliating, we, and he uses a crazy word here, we bless. Hashtag blessed. We see that going around everywhere, don't we? We are people that are blessed and we bless. And we say, Devin, how is that even possible? Not just to abstain from reacting or retaliating, but blessing. Like, it's one thing to not react and not retaliate. It's an entirely different thing to actively bless someone. And Peter says, instead of reacting, we are people of blessing. And here's the only way it's possible. It is grounded in our calling. And what Peter says here is you have been called to obtain an undeserved blessing. He says, as exiles, as Jesus followers, we bless because we have been blessed. And because we have been promised an eternal blessing. Here's what Peter's saying. You live like a blessed person lives. And when you have been blessed on this earth, an eternal blessing that is coming, you give out blessing instead of retaliating, reacting, lashing out in anger. So it's kind of a perspective issue, because sometimes we fail to see the blessing that we've been given through Christ, which results in us not being able to bless in times that we should be blessing instead of retaliating. And Peter says, when you understand the blessing that you've been given, then you live out a life of blessing. Here's how I like to phrase it. We choose grace over grudges. We live a life of grace over grudges. Because grudges are natural, grudges are easy. There was even a kind of horror movie made one time about a grudge, and if you saw the movie, it's like something that's sitting on their shoulders or something weighing them down. Like, there's some symbolism there, right? That a grudge is weighing you down and holds you captive. And Peter says, when we're Jesus followers that understand the blessing we receive, we choose grace over grudges. We get a blessing, and so we give a blessing. And there's a lot of Old Testament depth here from the Abrahamic covenant that you will be a blessed people that we don't have time to get into. But it impacts how we live. And then he turns to Psalm chapter 34. We read verse 10 earlier. Let's reread it. For whoever desires, and there it is, to love life and see good days, and then he gets specific with us, let him keep his tongue from evil, his lips from speaking deceit. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Let him seek peace and pursue it. And so he goes to Psalm 34, he quotes David when David was anticipating his covenant blessing from God, that God had promised David this covenant blessing. And so David's response to this promised blessing from God was that it impacted his everyday life. And so he says, what does this good life look like? It looks like a life that's been impacted by God's blessing. The good life is a life that's defined by what God has done on our behalf. So it doesn't have to do with a bank account or a house by the lake or toes in the sand. It has to do with the impact of God's grace on our lives. And then Peter says, when that's the case, again, he quotes David, it impacts everything. It impacts our words. That our words are honest. They're pure. They're without deceit. Now think about that in everyday relationships. What we just covered the last few weeks. If we were to live a life of pure words without deceit at work, what would that look like? That we don't lie to coworkers or lie to the boss. And even maybe more complicated is at home. If we're to live lives of pure words at home, that we speak with honesty and integrity to our spouse, like we talked about last week. Man, that can get complicated at times, right? Do these jeans make me look fat? Are you kidding me? We're going to be honest in that moment? What was that comedian said? It's not the jeans that are making you look fat. But we're living lives, what's he talking about here? That we're living lives of integrity and honest. And man, we're retaliation people, we're reaction people. You always do X, Y, and Z. You never do X, Y, and Z. And our words are sharp and they're biting and they're retaliatory. And Peter says, when you're living a good life that understands the impact of grace on your life, that your reaction is to use words that reflect that. They're pure and they're honest words that promote grace over grudges and blessing over retaliation. And then he says that we reject wrong, we do good, we pursue peace. We turn from evil. We do right. We pursue peace. These things define the life of the grace recipient. That he's looking for the good and the right and looking to turn from evil, and he's looking to pursue peace in times of conflict. Look at 12. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Peter says, you want to love life and see good days. Remember, God is watching and listening. What he's saying is that God is in control. And when we hear God is watching and listening, we usually think in negative terms, don't we? Like, I better watch what I say and do. But how Peter's using this, quoting Psalm 34, is you have a God who cares about the details of your life. A God who is in absolute control, that is watching and listening, not to send a lightning bolt from heaven, but a God who cares about the details of your life. A God who is so absolutely in control that he hears what you say and he watches what you do, because that's how much he cares for you. Think about a parent-child relationship. I don't watch over my children because I'm looking for them to do something wrong. I'm watching over my children because I love them and care for them at a level that I want to protect them from harm and danger. Are there times that my watching eye sees them do something wrong or hears them say something wrong that needs correcting? Absolutely. And that's part of the role of God and the Holy Spirit in our lives. But my kind of framework for life is I watch over those that God has entrusted to me, because I want what is absolutely best for them. And I care for the details of their life. And we have a Heavenly Father that is watching and is in absolute control over our lives. That life, listen to this, life cannot take me outside of the watchful eye of God and the listening ear of God. What a tremendous truth. And it really goes back to the idea of hope and confidence in who God is that goes throughout Peter's book. And then Peter tees it up for his audience. Remember who he's talking to? People that are facing real life suffering and opposition. And Peter tees it up. He goes to Psalm 34, and then look what he says in verse 13. Now, since I've kind of teed it up, who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is good? Peter asked this rhetorical question that's based on the previous verses. The person living this good life as defined by who you are in God, that you're a person that's received grace and blessing from God, this person that's living this good life defined by who Jesus is and who we are in Jesus, can't be harmed by life circumstances. Now, who is there that can harm you? He's not dismissing the reality of suffering or mistreatment or persecution or brokenness. He's just placing it in the proper framework that whatever happens in life is under God's control. And he shows us that he's a realist in verse 14. But even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. Have no fear of them, nor be troubled. As we've seen time and time and week, Peter's a realist. He takes it into real life. Godly people suffer. They're persecuted. They get hurt. The world's a broken place. Peter's not ignoring the brokenness. But he says, because of who you are, because of who you are in Jesus, because of whose you are, because you're under God's watchful eye and listening ear, our response is different. Suffering becomes a blessing, a privilege. What? Say, Devin, I must be a blessed person. Because I'm feeling some intense suffering and opposition and persecution right now. Here's what's going on in my life. Like I must be at the height of God's blessing list because I'm going through some stuff right now. Suffering is a blessing. There's times in life you feel really privileged because of what you're going through, right? Really what Peter's doing, he's echoing the words of Jesus in Matthew 5. Blessed are you when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. It doesn't mean life is easy. It doesn't mean that the brokenness is not a reality. What it means is that suffering pushes us to Jesus, which makes suffering in the long run, in the big picture, a blessing. Because it's pushing us into the one that we need the most. That we need Jesus. Which makes suffering in the New Testament a blessing. We read the verse several weeks ago where the disciples were facing intense persecution and they walked away. And the verse says they counted themselves worthy to suffer for the sake of Jesus. The blessing may not always be evident. It may not show up in the bank account. It may not show up in a healthy relationship all the time. The blessing sometimes may be one in disguise, but understand the perspective here. God is in absolute control. Whatever it is in life you're facing pushes you to Jesus. And as it pushes you to Jesus, look what it does. And what he said in verse 14, you have no fear, nor are you troubled. As we are pushed to Jesus, fear is pushed out. Because our ultimate confidence, our ultimate hope is in God. We live in a fear-filled culture. Afraid of losing this, afraid of that. Man, was it 3 days in a row this week? There were shootings across the country of multiple people dying. We live in a very fear-induced culture and unsure of what's going on around us and unsure of what's going on in our personal lives. And what Peter is saying is the more I am pushed into Jesus, the more fear is pushed out of my life. The whole framework, living a life of submission within society, within work, within home, within our individual lives, submission forces us to trust God. And God can be trusted. You see the cycle here? It's not Peter saying, go get trampled on. Go get taken advantage of. Just submit yourselves to whoever's over you and take whatever they dish out. What's Peter saying? Peter says that we live as exiles in this world, passing through. We are dual citizens in an earth with an eternal kingdom, living in a current kingdom that's temporary. We're passing through, and as we pass through, we realize that God is ultimately in control, that society is not in control, that governments are not in control, that my unfair boss at work is not in control, that the spouse that I'm having trouble getting along with at home is not in control, that God is in absolute control. And so whatever relationship situation I'm in, with society, with work, with home, whatever situation I'm in, it is pushing me into Jesus. I am leaning into Jesus. He is in control. I can rest in Him so that no matter what's going on in this world, I have hope and confidence because I rest in who He is. And that is not a source of fear. That is a source of hope and confidence in who I am in Christ. 15. Instead of living in fear, what do? But in your hearts, regard Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. So see the picture here. As we're living this life of confidence and hope in who Jesus is, it piques the interest of other people. You don't react the way that people normally react in this situation. I've noticed what you're going through in life and your reaction seems different. What is it about your home life, your relationship with your spouse that seems different than those around me? What is it while everybody's freaking out about the government and the president and who said what, that there seems to be a peace or a calmness about you that your confidence is not in whether it's Hillary or Donald or whoever it may be? It piques the interest of other people. As you live as a dual citizen, And Peter says, instead of living in fear, we live in awe of who God is, and it provides us an opportunity to offer a reason for the hope that is within us. The word here in the original language is the word apologia. It's where we get the word apologetics. The word apologetics is the defense of one's beliefs, that we defend our beliefs. It's a courtroom word, that you're able to be able to give a defense. And the question is, what are we defending? And Peter says, what we're defending is the hope that is in us, the confidence that is in us. It enables us to speak about Jesus. Now, if you're like me, I'm an apologetics guy. Like, let's line it up. You get your arguments, I'll get mine. We'll have a debate, and I'll talk you into why my reason's the best, right? That's kind of the way I picture apologetics. But look how he articulates apologetics in verse 16. Do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. Peter says, while you are defending your faith, the hope that is in you, you do it with gentleness and reverence, not pride, not arrogance, not belittling, that we are bold yet humble, and we are able to speak the truth in a way that points people to Jesus. You know how many people I have argued into becoming a follower of Jesus? Zero. You know how many people that I have lined up, here's all the reasons, here's all the defense, here's all the arguments that have become followers of Christ? None. Because it's not about winning the argument. It's about testifying, speaking of the hope that is within you. And when you are asked, being able to give a reason clearly with respect and gentleness. So it's not shying away from the truth. It's not refusing to talk about Jesus. It's doing it with an attitude that I have been a recipient of grace and blessing with good conscience in a way that's legitimate. So that when you are challenged, your life speaks of the hope, the authentic faith. See what, did you pick up on what Peter said in this verse? So that when you're slandered, when people talk bad against you, that those who revile, those who make fun of, those who ridicule your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. What Peter's saying is, if there are people who are speaking against you, criticizing, reviling you, that their words hold no weight because people can see your life. They see the hope that's within you. That they do not have an authentic reason to tear you down because your life is authentic. It speaks of the hope that is in you. And then 17. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if that should be God's will, than for doing evil. Peter says, if you're going to suffer, which his audience was, if you're going to suffer, let it be because you're doing what's right. Here's the bottom line of this whole passage, this whole section. Our walk and our talk should point people to Jesus. Our walk and our talk should point people to Jesus. Devin, man, that's a laundry list of items. Humility, sympathy, kindness, grace over grudges, not retaliating. Look what Peter does, verse 18. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit. Peter takes us right back to the supreme example and our source of hope during suffering. He takes us right back to Jesus, that we look to Jesus. I love what he says. This verse right here is a sermon in and of itself that we don't have time to preach. What he says in this verse is, he says the death of Jesus is enough, that he died once. He died. When Jesus died, everything that was necessary happened, that it is enough. that he died once for our sins. He says the death of Jesus is enough. He says the death of Jesus is an exchange. He said the righteous for the unrighteous. The great reformer Martin Luther called it the great exchange, that his righteousness replaces my unrighteousness, that I am made right with God in Jesus, that he takes my unrighteousness, my sin, and replaces it with his righteousness, with his holiness, so that when the Father sees me, he sees Jesus, his righteousness for my unrighteousness, the great exchange. And then he says the death of Jesus is enough. It's this great exchange, and the death of Jesus accomplishes his purpose. It's effective. It brings us to God, he says in verse 18, that he might bring us to God. He reconciles us, that what Jesus did, everything necessary to enable us to live out our faith, as Peter described, happened on the cross of Jesus Christ. That's enough, that his righteousness has replaced my unrighteousness, that what Jesus did was effective. It wasn't a crapshoot hoping people would come to faith in him, that when Jesus did on the cross, brought reconciliation, it happened. He did everything necessary. So here's what that means. As we traverse life's difficult path, we look to Jesus, that he suffered on my behalf so that my suffering points people back to Jesus in my life as I suffer, that it points me to Jesus, that is, and those around me as I live life and how I react and respond and how I suffer, that it points people to Jesus. Man, when I read this week, the first thing that came to my mind is like, I don't measure up. Are you kidding me? Harmonious? Sympathetic? Peter, do you know me? Loving, kind, humble. Instead of retaliating, we give blessing, choosing a grace over a grudge, guarding my tongue, doing good, abstaining from evil, pursuing peace, welcoming suffering into my life to point people to Jesus, ready to give a defense, to give a reason for the hope that is in me in a gentle and respective way. Man, that seems like a tough list. And it is, if I'm trying to do it on my own. And then I thought about this. Think about who wrote these words. It's Peter. That list describes nothing about the apostle we read about in the New Testament. Brash and arrogant, correcting Jesus, not responding in the right way, always retaliating, denying Jesus, cursing Jesus. Like, everything in Peter's list seems to be the opposite of his life when he was with Jesus. And it's why Peter takes us right back to the gospel, right? It's why he takes us right back to Jesus. Because the man writing these words could not muster up enough self-will and power to live by this list. And so he says to us, don't forget who our example is. Don't forget what happened on the cross to enable you to live life with confidence in who you are in Jesus. Listen to me. We are going to fail. We're going to blow it. We're going to sin. We're going to say the wrong things. We're going to react in the wrong way. There's going to be times that you hold grudges. There's going to be times that you question life. There's going to be times that you say, I don't know why I'm going through this. It doesn't make sense. I don't feel very close to Jesus right now. I don't want to trust God right now. There's going to be those times that you go through those things. And that's why it's not about the do's and the don'ts and trying to perfect some type of list-based life. That's why we need Jesus. It's why we rest in him. It's why he enables us. It's why when we fail in these areas of our life that he picks us back up time and time and time again. Because what he did on the cross is everything we need. He suffered for my sins and all the times I don't measure up. His righteousness has replaced my unrighteousness, which enables me to live a righteous life based on what he has done. He has reconciled me to God. He has redeemed me in my brokenness, and it is through him and only through him that I die to myself and I am made alive in Jesus. Don't be fooled into thinking, well, here's the magical list that's going to enable me to be made right with God. Peter says, don't miss. As we're living as dual citizens, this kingdom, the eternal kingdom, as we're living in the complexity of all these relationships and the brokenness and reacting in a way that honors Jesus and seeking harmony and kindness and living in our homes with honesty and integrity and husbands and wives and parents and workers and employees and employers and citizens, and as we're functioning in life. It's not a list that we put on our refrigerator that says, all right, here's all the things I got to check off. Peter says, remember that what happened on the cross enables you to navigate by God's grace the complexity of all those relationships, all those times in life, all those struggles, the grace of God. Remember the blessing that you have received and live it out. Live out the grace that has been poured on you. And when you fail, when you react the wrong way, we push back into Jesus. Jesus, it's happened again. I reacted the wrong way again. I failed again. I need you. I need you in this difficult relationship at work. I need you to enable me to love Ashley as she deserves to be loved, to love my kids as they deserve a father's love. Jesus, I need you in those moments when I tend to react, to enable me to respond like you responded. We rest in him. We lean into the gospel. And he picks us up and reminds us everything I've done, everything required, has been done on your behalf. If you're a parent, you've had those moments in life where you've had one of your kids, particularly when they're younger, when they might get afraid or uncertain, and their natural tendency is to hold on to you, right? Like, Daddy, I'm afraid. If it's a storm or something happening, and your natural tendency as a parent is to embrace them in those moments and to hold them tightly and closely so they feel your security, so they feel loved in those moments. And I think that's the picture that I imagine of how much I need Jesus. That in those moments of sin or uncertainty or insecurity, that there is a God who says, lean into me, rest in me, find your hope and confidence in me. And there's times he has to pick me back up, right? I'm not reaching up, that he's picking me up. He says, it's okay, Devin. It's okay. It's why I died. That's why I died. I am enough for you. Rest in me. Lean into me. I know what sins you've committed. I know how unworthy you feel. Rest in me. Lean into me. I know how insecure you are. I know your relationships are struggling. I know he's tough to get along with. Rest in me. Lean into me. It's why I died. Find your hope and confidence in me. It's grace and grace alone. Let's bow our heads for prayer.